Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Tides of History early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts. The hooves of mules and horses clopped on the wooden planks of the bridge, drowning out the burbling of the river. Nags whinnied and neighed, protesting against their riders and the loads straining their backs. The beasts, the only ones that could be found in the tiny hamlets of the Asturian coastline of northern Spain, hardly suited the elevated quality of their riders. These were some of the finest nobles in Europe, their fashionable velvets, woolens, and silks stained by the early fall mud coating the backwater tracks of this part of northern Spain. One young man in his late teens coughed through a mouth that was left slightly agape by a jutting, almost malformed jaw. His cheeks were flushed. He lifted a hand up and felt the heat of a fever, then shivered. His prominent teeth chattered despite the several cloaks trying to keep him warm amid the October mist. The nobleman around him eyed the young man with concern. His name was Charles, and he was the heir. The heir to everything, already the ruler of Flanders, Brabant, Burgundy, and Luxembourg. The king of Castile, Aragon, and Naples, traversing his new kingdoms in Spain for the very first time. He would one day inherit Austria, Tyrol, Styria, and Carinthia, and perhaps the throne of the Holy Roman Empire as well. This feverish, unbathed, not especially impressive adolescent was the endpoint of centuries of planning, calculation, war, and above all, strategic marriages. The mules and nags clopped on, crossing the bridge and setting off down yet another winding mountain track. The nobles tittered, complaining about sleeping on straw instead of feather mattresses, whining about the food, and silently contemplating the Asturian hillsides, the little patches of rock jutting through the brownish green of early fall foliage. Charles coughed again. If he fell ill and died, these noblemen knew that their power would disappear. All the claims to rights and lands and authority that the young, malleable king embodied would slip away. It all belonged to Charles, personally. He might not have been impressive, but they obeyed him nonetheless. He was and would be the most powerful and important European ruler in centuries. If, that was, the young Charles survived this unfortunate trip through the mountains to claim his new thrones. Hi, everybody. From Wondery, welcome to another episode of Tides of History. I'm Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. On February 24th, 1500, a baby was born in the Flemish city of Ghent. Ghent was a sizable city in a dense, rich, and populous region. There were lots of babies born there in the first year of the 16th century. But this one was special. He was special not so much because of his talents and gifts, but because of who his parents were, and who their parents were, and who their parents were. This baby's name was Charles, and he was born to be an heir. He inherited kingdoms, duchies, counties, margraviates, and even an empire. The lands that eventually became subject to him encompassed huge swaths of Europe, more than any ruler since Charlemagne. And Charles himself did only a little to make that happen. He simply survived to adulthood, no mean feat in itself in an age of serious infant and youth mortality. And therefore, because he survived, he inherited. That was what defined Charles. Inheritance. More than any action he performed, any law he promulgated, any deal he made, any advice he took, Charles was defined by what his ancestors had done. A long and illustrious lineage, actually a whole series of long and illustrious lineages, had led up to him. His ancestors included kings of France and England, lords of Milan, grand dukes of Lithuania, Holy Roman emperors, kings of Castile and Aragon, royalty and nobility from every corner of medieval Europe. The baby born in February of 1500, right on the cusp of a new century, was the culmination of generation after generation after generation of dynastic marriages and the politicking that went along with them. In this sense, the baby Charles, later King Charles I of Spain and Emperor Charles V of the Holy Roman Empire, among many other things, was the culmination of a large chunk of medieval politics as a whole. He was also the central figure of politics in the first half of the 16th century, the sun around whom everything else orbited. His dynasty, the Habsburgs, would play a key role in the politics of the entire early modern period, everywhere from the plains of Hungary to the Straits of Gibraltar. They were the central protagonists in the Dutch Revolt, the Spanish Armada, the Thirty Years' War, and more. Under Charles's rule, the first true global empire took hold, setting the template for the next five centuries of European world influence. Charles looked both forward and backward. Simultaneously medieval nobleman and early modern dynast, the endpoint of centuries of past processes and the beginning of many new things. All of this makes Charles a fascinating figure in European and world history, and that's how we're going to try to understand him in today's episode. What had to happen for Charles to exist? On the one hand, he was structurally inevitable, the result of centuries of dynastic consolidation, the defining theme of late medieval politics. This was an era of state building, and Charles inherited not just the titles and the claims, but also all those generations of effort. On the other hand, Charles only got all that for highly contingent reasons. Key players died untimely deaths, on the battlefield or tucked up safe in bed. Others who might have ruled instead of him were incapable of doing so. Charles was a meeting point between two eras, but he was also right at the intersection between structural forces and the accidents of a series of moments. On top of all that, Charles was an interesting character in his own right. Others will probably argue with my assessment of him, and I'm of course open to that, but what stands out to me is his sheer mediocrity. Actually, that might be just a bit too harsh. He was just very much the median nobleman of his day, with all the standard ideological predilections, concerns, and worldviews. Not an idiot, but not a genius either. Hardworking, to be sure, but not a workaholic. Not an incredibly gifted politician, but not a total failure either. Ruthless, but not a downright psychopath. He was just ordinary, notable more for his jutting jaw and his illustrious ancestry than any real personality traits of his own. That in itself is fascinating and telling. None of this makes him any less central to the era. Charles was everywhere, involved in everything, both entirely in control and a complete victim of circumstance. This makes him a wonderfully fascinating lens through which to view the period and to wrap up the major themes we've been discussing here on Tides for the last several years. State building, finance, economic history, voyages of exploration, and many more threads all come to a reasonable end in the person of Charles V. As we prepare to move on from the late Middle Ages and the early modern period, we're going to spend the next two episodes talking about Charles and his age and reflecting a bit on the era as a whole. Yes, my friends, we'll soon be leaving this period behind. The current plan is to do a year-long block of episodes on prehistory, from the origins of humanity up to the Bronze Age. But, given current circumstances, the precise order in which we'll be getting to new topics is uncertain. The show will continue no matter what. I have no doubt of that. It's just that everything's a bit up in the air right now. Stay tuned for more. So, a quick note before we go on. I'm relying heavily on the historian Jeffrey Parker's new biography of Charles V, Emperor, which is really excellent and totally thorough. My other key source is Karl Brandi and his book, The Emperor Charles V, which is quite aged, but still really valuable. Okay, with all that said, let's come back to Charles himself. His full styling went like this, and it's worth hearing it. Charles, by the grace of God, Holy Roman Emperor, forever August, King of Germany, King of Italy, King of all Spains, of Castile, Aragon, Leon, of Hungary, of Dalmatia, of Croatia, Navarra, Granada, Toledo, Valencia, Galicia, Mallorca, Sevilla, Cordoba, Murcia, Jaén, Algarves, Algeciras, Gibraltar, the Canary Islands, King of two Sicilies, of Sardinia, Corsica, King of Jerusalem, King of the Indies, of the islands and mainland of the Ocean Sea, Archduke of Austria, Duke of Burgundy, Brabant, Lorraine, Styria, Carinthia, Carniola, Limburg, Luxembourg, Gelderland, Neopatria, Württemberg, Landgrave of Alsace, Prince of Swabia, Asturias, and Catalonia, Count of Flanders, Habsburg, Tyrol, Gorizia, Barcelona, Artois, Burgundy, Palatine, Hainaut, Holland, Zeeland, Ferrette, Khyber, Namur, Roussillon, Cerdagne, Drenthe, Zutphen, Margrave of the Holy Roman Empire, Burgau, Oristano, and Gocciano, Lord of Frisia, the Wendish March, Pordenone, Biscay, Moline, Saline, Tripoli, and Mechelen. In concrete and real terms, only a little less impressive than the full style, Charles held the following titles: Holy Roman Emperor, King of Castile and Leon, King of Aragon and Sicily, King of Naples, King of the Romans, Duke of Burgundy, Duke of Brabant, Limburg, Lothair, and Luxembourg, Margrave of Namur, Count Palatine of Burgundy, Count of Artois, Flanders, Charolais, Hainaut, Holland, Zealand, and Barcelona. After a short, sharp war in 1543, he also became Duke of Guelders and Count of Zutphen, for good measure. Whew. If that sounds like a lot, well, that's because it is a lot. We're going to start by trying to understand exactly how all of that came together, because it tells us a great deal about the last couple of centuries of medieval politics. Charles's father was Philip the Handsome, Duke of Burgundy, son of the Holy Roman Emperor Maximilian and Mary of Burgundy. His mother was the Infanta, or Princess, Juana, daughter of Queen Isabella of Castile and King Ferdinand of Aragon. Charles was the eldest son of this couple, which meant that Charles was the heir to three of the most rapaciously acquisitive dynasties in later medieval Europe: the Valois Dukes of Burgundy, the Habsburgs of Austria and the Holy Roman Empire, and the Trastámaras of Castile and Aragon were all immensely successful in accumulating lands, titles, and claims to still more. All three of those lines came together in the person of Charles himself. Let's look at them one by one. First up, the Valois Dukes of Burgundy. Charles was the great-grandson of Charles the Bold, who had his head split open by a Swiss halberd at the Battle of Nancy in 1477. But prior to his death, Charles had been a pretty successful ruler. The Valois Dukes had been a cadet branch, a younger branch of the French royal house. The favored son of King John II of France was Philip the Bold, his youngest, and Philip got a plum prize all the way back in the 14th century: the Duchy of Burgundy, to which Philip the Bold added the County of Flanders through his marriage to a lovely heiress. From then on, the Dukes of Burgundy added territory after territory, eventually assembling lands that stretched from Flanders down through the Rhineland to the border of Switzerland. Had Charles the Bold not died at Nancy, he might have founded a brand new kingdom of his own, something a little bit more lasting. Unfortunately for him, Charles did lose his life, and all his royal dreams died with him. Charles the Bold had no sons, only a daughter, the 19-year-old Mary, and she was under enormous pressure to choose a husband who could help her control her brand new inheritance. There were a few options available for Mary, and the one she picked was the 18-year-old Maximilian, son of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III and a member of the powerful Habsburg dynasty. Maximilian was dashing and bold. He rode hundreds of miles through hostile territory with only a few attendants to make an impression on Mary and win her hand. In addition to being politically savvy, this move spoke powerfully to the romantic and chivalric mores of the time. It was classic knight stuff. Mary and Maximilian were only married for a few years before her own untimely death due to a riding accident. But in that time, Maximilian and Mary had two children, a boy named Philip and a daughter named Margaret. Thanks to his mother's early death, Philip had already inherited all the scattered, extensive, and rich territories of Burgundy. He was also his father's heir in the elder line of the Habsburgs, which meant that he would inherit the Archduchy of Austria and would stand a good chance of being elected Holy Roman Emperor as well. The Habsburgs had married their way into territory after territory over the centuries. Maximilian had no intention of missing the opportunity his son and daughter represented. They were two of the most eligible nobles in Europe, and he would find the right match for them. That match turned out to be a double marriage with the Trastámaras of Spain, who had two eligible royal children of their own. Isabella of Castile and Ferdinand of Aragon were cousins themselves. They were both members of the same dynasty, which had spent the past several centuries wrangling control not just of Castile and Aragon, but also Sicily and, through another cousin, the Kingdom of Naples. Like Maximilian and Mary of Burgundy, Ferdinand and Isabella had come together under rocky circumstances. Just like Maximilian, Ferdinand had undertaken a long and dangerous ride through hundreds of miles of hostile territory, straight out of a chivalric romance, to claim his bride. Isabella and Ferdinand had a whole bunch of children. The eldest, Isabella, married the King of Portugal. The next two, Juan and Juana, confusingly enough, were the matches for Maximilian and Mary's two children. Juan married Margaret, and Juana married Philip. This was where the contingency, the luck, and the accidents really came into play. Actually, it had begun even before the double wedding. Margaret had previously been betrothed to Charles, the young king of France, but he rejected her in favor of Anne, the heiress of Brittany. When Margaret was sent packing back to her father, that made the double marriage with the Trastámaras a possibility in the first place. This secured the match not only for her, but also for Philip. So let's run down the contingencies from here. First, Prince Juan, never a healthy young man, grew ill and died late in 1497. He had been the heir to Castile and Aragon. Now Ferdinand and Isabella's eldest daughter, also named Isabella, would be the heir. But then Isabella too died, aged just 27 the following year. That's a whole other story involving extreme religious practices, a little bit of anti-Semitism, fasting, and self-scourging after the death of her first husband. Isabella died giving birth to a son, little Prince Miguel, who likewise died just before his second birthday. After Isabella and Miguel's deaths, Juana, Philip's young wife, would be queen of Castile and Aragon, and Philip would be king, jure uxoris, by law of his wife, or by right of his wife. So, through absolutely no doing of his own, and a combination of deliberate dynastic marriage and total accident, Charles became, at the tender age of 5 months, the only living male heir to all of his grandparents' vast lands. Everywhere from Austria to the Netherlands to Spain, to the growing but still unimportant overseas territories in the Caribbean, would eventually belong to him, if he could survive to adulthood. This was the end point of centuries of consolidation, of grasping nobles and royals, seizing titles and claims through purchase, force, and the astute use of the bedchamber. The last two centuries of medieval politics had all been leading in this direction, and a few untimely deaths brought them all to fruition. Charles was the culmination.
If you travel, you know how to pull off a perfect getaway. You know, after you enroll with your Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card, you get up to $10 back monthly on U.S. rideshare purchases with select providers, like a car to the airport. You know which remote retreats have the best herbal baths and where the Wi-Fi password is rarely used, because you're the escape artist. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Purchases must be on card. Visit go.amex/you know.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of the hunt. But are you getting the thrill of the best deals? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores, like Urban Outfitters, Fenty Beauty, and Expedia. And even stack sales on top of cash back. It's easy to use, and you get your cash back through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal, or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
As Charles grew first into childhood and then adolescence, he began to inherit, and inherit some more. This was the product of several things. The structural tendency toward consolidation, the deeply dysfunctional combination of family dynamics and dynastic politics, and last but certainly not least, the contingencies and accidents over which nobody had any control. In 1504, Charles's grandmother Isabella died. This left the crown of Castile to her eldest surviving child, Charles's mother, Juana. A clash with the wily old Ferdinand of Aragon, one of the most ruthless and most successful politicians of this era, became inevitable. Isabella's will complicated things. If Juana was absent or unable to rule, it said that Ferdinand could continue doing so, at least until Juana's heir, little Charles, came of age. Philip of Burgundy, Charles's father, was a Habsburg through and through. He wasn't going to miss the opportunity to claim what he regarded as his kingdom, Castile. Jure uxoris, by right of his wife, Philip intended to rule Castile. But whatever the will said, no matter what Philip intended to do, Ferdinand wasn't about to give up Castile to his daughter, much less to a Habsburg son-in-law. Ferdinand managed to convince the Cortes of Castile, the representative body, that Juana was incapable of ruling on her own. For now, he kept control. Things got more complicated still. The great enemy of Maximilian and Philip was Louis XII, the King of France. With Isabella barely cold in the ground, Ferdinand concluded an alliance with Louis, marrying his niece, Germaine de Foix. If Ferdinand would not accept the loss of Castile, neither would Philip allow his father-in-law to rule there, not when his wife should have succeeded her mother. But at the same time, Philip didn't intend for his wife to rule either. Philip and Juana had a mercurial, unfortunate, and by our standards, abusive relationship. In fact, it's a deeply sad story. Philip was extremely controlling. Even within her own household, Juana never had any real control. Most of the Spanish servants who went to the Netherlands with her were dismissed or returned home, leaving Philip to surround her with his people. Royal daughters like Juana, married into foreign courts, were normally expected to advance their parents' political standing. Juana was unable to, largely because Philip controlled her household finances and expenditures. She could not influence him in any meaningful way. To add insult to injury, when little Miguel died, Philip immediately began styling himself Prince of Asturias, the title normally reserved for the heir to the throne of Castile. Much has been said and written about Juana. She still has the unfortunate appellation La Loca, the mad. But making everything about madness masks the sheer complexity of both her mental health and the political and familial circumstances in which she found herself. On top of that, people in the past didn't have our clinical and diagnostic ways of understanding mental illness. They processed issues of sanity and madness through political and cultural lenses that are foreign to us. Just imagine being a teenaged princess who had never been allowed the capacity for self-governance, sent hundreds of miles from home to marry a man who routinely drank, debauched, and kept mistresses, to live in a foreign court without reliable and familiar faces. No wonder Juana had issues. And for a variety of reasons, the powerful figures around Juana, especially her father, Ferdinand, and her husband, Philip, found it beneficial to portray her as incapable of ruling in her own right. Whatever the truth of Juana's mental state, and it's impossible for us to know, Ferdinand and Philip used the language of madness and incapacity to thwart any attempt she ever made to claim power for herself. Philip died in Spain in September of 1506, aged only 28, shortly after he and Juana arrived in their new kingdom. It happened so quickly that Ferdinand was suspected of poisoning his son-in-law to head off the inevitable conflict over control of Juana and thus over Castile. Juana, lending credence to the whispers of madness, grew deeply attached to Philip's corpse, keeping the coffin with her as she traveled through Castile. Disorders and uncertainty plagued the kingdom, and Ferdinand, along with a cabal of powerful officials, effectively seized control. The historian Bethany Aram, who's made an exhaustive study of Juana, suggests that she probably did what she felt was necessary to protect her son Charles's inheritance. She refused to remarry, she retreated to a convent, and she gave her father a free hand to rule in her stead. It took extensive negotiations between the old Emperor Maximilian, Philip's father and Charles's grandfather, and Ferdinand to stop Maximilian from bringing Charles to Spain and claiming the rule of the kingdom for himself until Charles came of age. Eventually, Maximilian and Ferdinand and the other players all agreed that Ferdinand would rule Castile with the aid of the Cortes, a representative body, on Juana's behalf. Young Charles knew little or nothing of this. He turned 6 years old the year his father died. His parents had left him behind in the Netherlands, under the care of Guillaume of Croy, Baron Chievre, who would go on to be Charles's closest advisor until his death. When Maximilian learned of Philip's demise, he summoned his daughter Margaret, Charles's aunt, to govern the Netherlands and take control of the young prince's household. Everybody knew what Charles represented. He was the heir. Vincenzo Quirino, the Venetian ambassador, offered a portrait of the little boy. Quote, a handsome and happy child, Quirino wrote, but, quote, in all his deeds he showed himself willful and cruel, like old Duke Charles the Bold of Burgundy. That was not a compliment, especially for a little boy. Still, Charles could have been raised under far worse circumstances. His Aunt Margaret had lived an eventful life. She spent her youth at the French court before King Charles, who eventually died after hitting his head on a doorway, brutally repudiated her and sent her home. Margaret's first husband, Prince Juan, died after only a few months. Her second, the Duke of Savoy, lasted 3 years before he too died. Heartbroken and twice widowed, Margaret returned home once again. She did most of the work in raising Charles and his sisters, Eleanor and Isabella, and she was the greatest influence on the young prince. Margaret was exceptionally talented, a natural politician, administrator, and leader. If we're being honest, she was probably the most gifted person in her family, compared to her father Maximilian and her nephew Charles. She took charge the moment she arrived in Mechelen, the town just outside Antwerp where Charles was staying in his parents' absence. Margaret began presenting her nephew as the legitimate, rightful ruler of the territories he had just inherited from his dead father. She put him out in public, she gave him the Sword of Justice, and had him dubbed a knight during the services for the deceased Philip. Now, this wasn't enough to get the notoriously stingy representative bodies of the Netherlands to vote in favor of new taxes, but it was Charles's first time in the public eye as a ruler in his own right. Margaret put her considerable talents to use in creating the dazzling, sophisticated court in which she raised her nephew and nieces. She had paintings by Jan van Eyck and Hieronymus Bosch, two of the greatest artists of the Northern Renaissance, among many others. She had artifacts from the New World. She had a library full of beautiful manuscripts. Unfortunately, Charles was an indifferent student at best, no matter the quality of intellectual life surrounding him. He could barely write in any language by the age of 8, and he would never be renowned for his gifts in that arena. Despite that minor shortcoming, Charles and his sisters adored their aunt. Quote, "The affection I bear you is not only that of a nephew toward his aunt, but that of a good son toward his true and loving mother," Charles wrote years later. For her part, Margaret instilled vital social skills, she kept them out of trouble, and she instilled a bone-deep understanding of the centrality of the Habsburg dynasty. Margaret was one of the two major formative influences on young Prince Charles. The other was his grandfather, Maximilian, the Holy Roman Emperor and the Archduke of Austria. Maximilian is one of my favorite people in this whole era, a wonderfully three-dimensional character. He was impossibly ambitious and a dreamer, whose reach always exceeded his grasp. But he was also a hard-nosed realist, who had few illusions about his life and achievements. He was a warrior by nature, but one with a decidedly mixed record. He was a clever user of financial techniques, but he was perpetually penniless. He was a ruthless and backstabbing politician, and also one who understood the value of public opinion. Maximilian was an only child, the son of the Holy Roman Emperor Frederick III, and despite his illustrious heritage, had grown up lonely, without many frills or luxuries in his life. His father was a survivor who lasted more than 40 years on the imperial throne, but he never accomplished much of note. Maximilian was determined to be the opposite, and he achieved a great deal, albeit with what we might generously call mixed results. Maximilian had intended great things for his son Philip, but Philip had died at the age of 28. The emperor had many illegitimate children, far more than he could ever remember at one time, and he remarried after the death of Mary of Burgundy, but he had no more legitimate children with his next wife, the daughter of the Duke of Milan, Bianca Maria Sforza. Whatever he did or failed to do, Maximilian invested all of his remaining expansive hopes for the future of the Habsburg dynasty in his eldest grandson. Charles was already the Duke of Burgundy and the ruler of the Netherlands, lands Maximilian had spent most of his adult life safeguarding until Philip came of age. Now he was determined to do the same for young Charles, working through his daughter Margaret, until, that was, Charles could rule for himself. On top of all of that, Charles was also Maximilian's heir. "Having thus shown you the way," Maximilian wrote to Charles in 1513, "I leave things to you so you can valiantly defend what you have, as our predecessors have done for over 100 years. These were grand words from the old emperor, befitting a slightly buffoonish but still formidable figure. By the time Charles was 13, Maximilian was already determined to win the imperial crown for his grandson, on top of all the Spanish territories he was in line to inherit. Charles would succeed where Maximilian had failed. For his part, Charles practically worshipped his grandfather. Maximilian only visited on 4 occasions during Charles's youth, but each visit was fairly lengthy. Maximilian wrote regularly, and he wrote his extensive memoirs, called Der Weisskönig, the White/Wise King, without a trace of irony, to help educate Charles along the lines that Maximilian saw fit. Charles ate up all these lessons, things like valuing war and reputation over financial discipline, an obsession with self-image and how he was viewed by his subjects and competitors. Maximilian was full of reasonably good advice. Charles should learn many languages, including French, Dutch, and eventually Spanish, Italian, and some German. He should excel at hunting, hawking, and jousting, all the activities beloved of the nobility who would be his most important political constituency. And Charles should be exposed to the new humanist learning, particularly with its emphasis on history. Maximilian was a deeply flawed man. He exasperated his daughter Margaret, a far more level-headed and realistic operator. She once wrote to her father's advisors that Maximilian, quote, should tell me first what he has decided to do and not do as he usually does, which is to write one thing to me and then do something else. The perpetually bankrupt Maximilian once handed over part of the province of Franche-Comté to his creditors. Only problem? That was a province that belonged to Margaret. Maximilian fired back, once calling her letters so, quote, unreasonable that I think you must take me for a Frenchman, which was the most damning insult he could think of. But they needed each other. Maximilian couldn't govern without Margaret, and Maximilian was the head of the dynasty. Charles needed them both. Margaret kept Charles safe, and she kept his most important lands, the Netherlands, in good order while he grew up. Maximilian made him the kind of prince who could appeal to a still warlike nobility that distrusted book learning and valued prowess with arms, riding, fighting, and hunting more than anything else. That was the kind of prince Maximilian wanted, and that Charles grew into being. Maximilian loved taking Charles hunting with him. Margaret once had a 12-year-old Charles show off his skill with a longbow, the national weapon of England, to a cadre of English ambassadors. One of them wrote that Charles, quote, handled his bow right well. But what kind of young man was Charles? What stood out? Two things were clear. He was reasonably tall and well-built, the product of all his physical activities, but he had a jutting, almost malformed jaw that meant his mouth was almost always hanging open. And second, Charles was pious, usually attending not one, but two masses every day. But outside of that, contemporaries found little worth noting. He didn't take the initiative. He spoke little, perhaps because of that jaw. His advisors did most of the speaking and apparently the thinking for him. Few incidents, outside stock descriptions that could have been applied to almost anybody, struck observers as memorable. Just before he left for Spain, sometime in the winter of 1515 to 1516, the young man used a dagger to carve his motto into the window frame of his quarters in Brussels. Plus ultra in French, meaning still further. Translated into Latin as plus ultra, it would become Charles's motto for years to come. He'd probably gotten it from a chivalric romance he'd read. In the words of Charles's most recent and accomplished biographer, Geoffrey Parker, this absence of evidence no doubt reflects the fact that young Charles rarely did or said anything memorable. On the cusp of acquiring his thrones in Spain, that's the best we can say about the most important political figure of the age. I'd say that's pretty telling.
If you travel for work, you know to pack two suits, business and swim. You know with your Delta SkyMiles Business Amex card, buying that plane ticket for a business trip can get you closer to medallion status. You know that a meeting in Montana means visiting almost every national park.
Yellowstone? Check.
Because you're the chief excursion officer. It's why you're a Delta SkyMiles Platinum Business American Express card member. If you travel, you know. Terms apply. Visit go.amex/you-know-business.
You might wonder why we've spent all this time focusing on Charles's family. We've barely talked about Charles himself or any of the famous things that happened during his life and reign. Fair enough, I say. Here's the reason. It's because well into his 20s, Charles was dominated by other people. First his parents, then his ambitious and buffoonish grandfather, and then a series of advisors whom we'll talk more about shortly. These dynamics, both familial and dynastic, determined what Charles did far more than anything he himself might have wanted. He was a prisoner of his ancestry as much as its beneficiary. That doesn't mean we have to weep for one of the most privileged people to ever walk the face of the planet. It just means that as a political figure, it would behoove us to understand where he was coming from, literally. In this third and final section of today's episode, we're going to follow the young prince as he finally started to act in his own right, continuing the pattern set for him and beginning to make a few decisions of his own. On January 23, 1516, old King Ferdinand of Aragon finally died, aged 63. Ferdinand's death meant that the time had finally come for the young Charles to claim his Spanish kingdoms, the inheritance that had been looming over him for the past decade. Let's reflect on this for just a moment. Charles had never met his grandfather Ferdinand. He had never been to Spain. He didn't speak a word of any Iberian Romance language. Not Castilian, not Catalan, not Andalusian, not Galician, nothing. There were some 50 Spaniards at his court. They were mostly unimportant people who had supported his father Philip instead of Ferdinand. The Burgundians around whom he'd grown up dominated his close circle. The Lord of Chievre, his tutor Adrian of Utrecht, his father's close friend and confidant, Henry of Nassau, and so on. The upshot was that Charles had zero first-hand experience with the kingdoms, plural, that he was about to inherit, and the key decision-makers around him were nearly as ignorant as he was. This all matters a great deal. We have to remember that even what we're calling Spain was an amalgam of several kingdoms and other territories, each of which had its own laws, fiscal systems, and constituencies that had to be managed. But the Cortes, the representative body of Castile, did had nothing to do with the courts of Aragon. They had even less to do with the Estates General of Charles's Low Countries, or the financiers of Antwerp, or the merchants of Barcelona, or the powerful barons of Naples, which, oh yeah, was a whole other kingdom that Charles was about to inherit from Ferdinand. They were all distinct, and Charles, and the people on whom he relied to help him, knew very little about what they were about to deal with. You'd think that with Ferdinand dead, it would be simple enough for Charles, whom everybody agreed was the heir, to take over. But nothing with Ferdinand could ever be simple. It took months of negotiations prior to Ferdinand's death, carried out by Charles's trusted tutor, Adrian of Utrecht, to get Ferdinand to name Charles his universal heir. As soon as the deal was agreed, literally on his deathbed, Ferdinand went back on it, naming Charles governor of his kingdoms, but Juana his actual heir, and putting trusted Spanish servants in charge until Charles arrived in person. This was, to put it mildly, a recipe for disaster. The powerful Cardinal Cisneros, who had been regent and governor of Castile for years beforehand, essentially seized power and took control of the kingdom's government. What could Charles, hundreds of miles away, do about it? And that was just the beginning of the troubles. Juana was the perfect figurehead for someone else to use to seize power. Charles had a younger brother, also named Ferdinand, who had spent his entire life living in Spain. He even shared a birthday with old King Ferdinand. A faction of nobles or officials could raise up young Ferdinand as king and leave Charles in the lurch. What was he going to do about it? Being the heir, and everybody knew Charles was the heir, didn't guarantee that he'd actually get to rule. The tensions began almost immediately. Charles began referring to himself as king right away, which irked both Cardinal Cisneros and the Castilians more generally. It took months for some cities to acknowledge Charles as king. Those were problems, but they paled in comparison to the dangers posed by Charles's neighbor, King Francis I of France. Francis was young, strapping, and already a successful warrior king at the tender age of 21. Just the past year, in 1515, he had won a shattering defeat over the Swiss at the Battle of Marignano and claimed control over the Duchy of Milan. This, more than anything else, was why Charles didn't immediately go to Spain to claim his brand new inheritance. He had just turned 16. He was totally unknown there. He had no reputation for military capacity. If he left the Netherlands, the French could attack at will. Nothing was stopping them from heading south through the Papal States toward Naples, or making a play for Barcelona, or the Kingdom of Navarre in northern Spain. Charles thought of himself as a Burgundian prince. Flanders, Brabant, Luxembourg, Holland, those were the territories he thought of as home. The same was true, remember, of all his closest advisors. What was Spain or Naples to them? Home had to be safeguarded first, and that was what they did. For the time being, Cardinal Cisneros ruled Spain in the name of Juana on Charles's behalf. It was an unwieldy but momentarily workable series of arrangements. Cisneros was nobody's fool, an experienced administrator and leader with literally decades of experience running everything from the Spanish Inquisition to the entire Kingdom of Castile. Yet even Cisneros couldn't maintain control forever. When some powerful Castilian grandees showed up, asking by what right Cisneros ruled, the cardinal, well, he pointed to a bunch of cannon. That was crude if effective, but it couldn't work forever. Meanwhile, Charles dithered. It took more than a year for him to make the proper arrangements to head to Spain, and Maximilian had to travel to the Netherlands to convince the new king to actually go to his new dominions. Charles finally left the Netherlands for Spain in September of 1517, more than a year and a half after his grandfather Ferdinand's death. It was an ignominious arrival. Instead of showing up at a fine port in northern Spain, with banners flying and an illustrious welcoming party waiting for their new king, the fleet showed up at the tiny village of Villaviciosa in Asturias. This was a rocky little cove at the mouth of a small river in one of the poorest, most isolated parts of Charles's new kingdom. It was hardly an auspicious beginning. It took weeks of slow travel for the king to arrive at someplace more civilized, during which time Charles grew seriously ill. This was not the introduction to Spain he or his advisors had been hoping for. To make matters worse, Cisneros died shortly after Charles's arrival, leaving him without one of the very few people with the knowledge and the proven ability to help the new king rule. Perhaps if Cisneros had lived, he might have been able to prevent Charles from making a few of the many errors he immediately committed. Charles nominated his advisor Xiefra's 19-year-old nephew to the Archbishopric of Toledo, the seat that Cisneros had occupied. This was an explicit breach of Queen Isabella's will, and it would have been a major faux pas even if it hadn't. To make matters worse, Alfonso de Aragon, one of old King Ferdinand's many illegitimate children and the Archbishop of Zaragoza to boot, had wanted Toledo for himself. Alfonso was a powerful and influential nobleman. Charles not only didn't give him Toledo, he wrote to Alfonso to tell him not to bother coming to visit. Alfonso was Charles's uncle. He was a key player in the politics of Spain in general and Aragon in particular. Alienating him while appointing an unqualified foreigner to the most important ecclesiastical post in Castile was tone-deaf and foolish. The young king saw his mother, Queen Juana, for the first time in more than a decade. He conspired to keep her effectively imprisoned in Tordesillas, maintaining a fantasy world in which her father Ferdinand was still alive, the better to keep her under control. That was cruel, but Charles treated his younger brother, Ferdinand, even worse. He feared that Ferdinand, who was known to and favored by the Spanish aristocracy since he'd grown up in Spain, might be used as a pawn in a plot against him. He had promised that Ferdinand would stay put, but instead Charles immediately separated his brother from all his childhood companions and sent him north to the Netherlands, a place he had never been. Piling emotional manipulation on top of political concerns, Charles told his brother to regard him not just as a sibling, but as a father figure. Great parenting right there, sending a brother he had never met to a land he'd never been to, essentially by himself. None of this disposed Charles's new subjects particularly favorably toward him. The new king slowly progressed through his territories, trying to put out the numerous figurative fires that cropped up either on their own account or because of Charles's mismanagement. He bargained with the Cortes of Castile, the courts of Aragon, the representatives of Catalonia, his uncle Alfonso, and none of that entirely successfully. Again, Charles did not speak a word of any Spanish dialect. His advisors, including the all-important Xiefra, were either French or Dutch speakers. All of them were foreign to Spain. Luckily for Charles, it was around this time, through 1518, that he picked up a few new key officials. Francisco de los Cobos was a financial wizard who served as Charles's secretary, the key architect of the Byzantine schemes that funded the king's activities. Nobody knew Castilian finances better, and Charles desperately needed some Spanish expertise. The other important new addition was Mercurino de Gattinara, an experienced lawyer and politician originally from Savoy. Gattinara had spent years advising Maximilian and Margaret, and now, at this moment of great need, he arrived to give some coherence to Charles's plans. Gattinara, who assumed the role of Grand Chancellor, was essential because he provided the major ideological framework for Charles's entire reign, the idea of universal empire. Like Charles himself, this ideal spanned two eras. It had firmly medieval antecedents, especially its aspirations toward Christian unity and crusade, but it was also rooted in the contemporary goal of absolute rulership, and found its expression in a ruler who had assembled a diverse block of dynastic territories. Gattinara essentially provided a way for Charles to understand himself and his life as a king, not just as a ruler of a haphazard collection of territories brought together by the accidents of birth and marriage, but the core of a divinely mandated empire that would unite the Christian world. At least that was the idea. It was one Charles and Gattinara took seriously, but it was always more of an amorphous concept than a reality. Not that Charles was unaware of the difficulties. The sheer complexity of his position was always brutally clear to him. It was even clearer to men like Gattinara and Francisco de los Cobos, who had to navigate the often absurd ins and outs of ruling not one, but a series of states. Each of those states was itself an amalgam of smaller political units, each with its own rules, laws, and people who had to be understood, cajoled, and bullied. By the waning months of 1518, Charles had more than enough on his plate, more titles and lands and responsibilities than anybody had held for centuries. But there was one more great project left for the 18-year-old king, his grandfather Maximilian's title of Holy Roman Emperor. On the one hand, the emperor's rule over much of Central Europe was loose at best. His powers were limited. The lands supposedly subject to him were largely free of direct control. But being the emperor still mattered. It was a role with enormous possibilities, legal and political, if harnessed to the right ruler with the right advisors and subordinates under the right circumstances. That ruler had most decidedly not been Maximilian's father, Frederick III. Maximilian had tried to resurrect the ancient imperial claims of his predecessors, especially in Italy, but as with so many things, the old braggart's reach had exceeded his grasp. Maximilian was hardly unaware of that. Quote, "You see that I have expended my blood, my money, and my youth for the empire and got nothing for it," Maximilian said in 1513. And yet Maximilian went on. Quote, "I would like this young lord, my grandson Charles, to be elected emperor, because as you can see, there is no one with the capacity or the power to uphold the reputation of the empire except him." As in everything else, Maximilian intended for Charles to follow him, to succeed where he had failed. That was, as with everything in Maximilian's long life and reign, easier said than done. Holy Roman Emperor was an elected position. Sure, it had belonged to members of the Habsburg family for most of the past century, but that was no guarantee that the seven electors who chose the emperor would do so again just because Maximilian wanted them to. The archbishops of Mainz, Trier, and Cologne, the Elector Palatine of the Rhineland, the Margrave of Brandenburg, the Duke of Saxony, and the King of Bohemia. Those were the seven electors, and they intended to sell their votes dearly. By 1518, it was clear that Maximilian was nearing the end of his life. He had lived long and hard, hunting and fighting and riding and ruling until he was dramatically worn down. Everybody knew this, and so the jockeying for the succession was well advanced. Maximilian himself knew it, and he knew Charles would have competition, formidable competition, for the throne. Two contenders made themselves known as Maximilian faded. Henry VIII, King of England, married to Charles's aunt Catherine of Aragon and an on-again, off-again ally of the young King of Spain. And, far more seriously, Charles's great rival and enemy, Francis I, King of France. Henry's interest in the empire was never more than a passing fancy, but Francis was set on it. So what if the King of France spent his treasure and blood to acquire a throne without much in the way of real power and authority? The empire was a burden, wrangling its margraves and dukes and free cities and archbishops toward any particular purpose was the work of a long and unsatisfactory lifetime. Why not just let the Holy Roman Empire pass to Francis? One simple reason. Because being emperor would allow Francis to intervene in Italian affairs whenever he pleased. That meant Naples and Sicily would be vulnerable to Francis's whim. The King of France could threaten Charles's territories in Austria, which would pass to him when Maximilian died, from every direction, since he already held Milan as well. French armies could invade the Netherlands, which Charles still thought of as home, from east of the Rhine and northern France simultaneously. In other words, Francis as emperor would be an existential strategic threat to Charles's vast, scattered, and difficult-to-defend territories. That was leaving aside the dynastic angle, which also mattered a great deal. To Maximilian and Charles, being emperor was a Habsburg right that had to be preserved within the family at all costs. The stage was set for one of the most expensive undertakings in history. Francis had already bribed several of the electors for their votes in the upcoming election. Charles would have to outbid one of the richest monarchs in Europe. Luckily, Maximilian had spent decades cultivating a deep relationship with the Fugger family of bankers, among other Augsburg financiers. Maximilian had always been willing to borrow and spend freely, far more freely than he should have, if we're being honest about it. And now he intended to spend the resources of his grandson's new kingdoms in Spain to buy an empire. Correspondence flew back and forth between Charles's court in Spain and Maximilian, increasingly blunt messages and demands. "If you aspire to gain this crown," Maximilian wrote, "you must not hold back any resource." Maximilian demanded huge amounts of cash and Charles' sister Catalina, whom he intended to dangle as a marriageable prize. Just a week later, Maximilian got more passive-aggressive. "We see no way of conducting this matter as the desire and honor of both of us requires, and if there is any fault or negligence, we will feel greatly displeased that we have gone to so much trouble and effort throughout our life to aggrandize and exalt our dynasty and our posterity, and yet by your negligence, everything should collapse and jeopardize all our kingdoms, dominions, and lordship, and thus our succession. Take this matter to heart for the good of our dynasty, as we are doing." As if that weren't enough, Jakob Willinger, Maximilian's treasurer, was still blunter. "You already know the importance of this business, but let me refresh your memory," he wrote. "Electing Charles would allow him, quote, to subjugate our enemies and those who wish us ill, while the reverse would plunge us into total misery and confusion, which we would always bitterly regret." Months of messages like this passed back and forth while Maximilian offered more and more and more and still more money. But before anything could be agreed, Maximilian died on January 12, 1519. Everything was up in the air. It looked, for the moment, as if Francis had won. Luckily for Charles, he had two things going for him. First, the Fuggers, and second, his Aunt Margaret, who largely took over the business of negotiating with the electors for Maximilian. When Charles compared the empire to a horse and complained that it was an expensive one, Margaret wrote back, quote, "We are well aware that the horse is expensive, but it is of such a sort that if you do not want it, another buyer stands ready." Finally, after a long charm offensive and months of negotiations and preparations, Charles had his throne. It cost him dearly. Jakob Fugger loaned him more than 550,000 florins, far more than his annual income, secured with the revenues of Spain. Other bankers loaned still more. But Charles would be emperor. The 19-year-old would-be universal ruler would have his sweeping claim to authority, his lands stretching from Mexico to Spain to the Netherlands to the edge of the Hungarian plain. He had reached the culminating point of medieval politics. He had fulfilled even Maximilian's grandest ambitions. But there were limits to what Charles could do. Over the next decade, those limits became clear. As Protestants emerged in Germany, Spain exploded into rebellion, war after war with France erupted, and the Ottomans advanced relentlessly into Central Europe. Charles had to be everywhere at once, and no ruler could handle it all. That's what we'll talk about next time on Tides of History. Until then, thanks so much for joining me. Be sure and hit me up if you'd like to chat about anything we've talked about here on Tides, or something you'd like to see. You can find me on Twitter at @Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at @PatrickWymanMMA. You can follow the show at Tides History. If you haven't already, don't forget to subscribe to Tides of History on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you're listening to this right now. If you've been enjoying the show, I'd really appreciate it if you left a 5-star rating and a review. Tides of History is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The sound design is by Derek Behrens for Airship. The sound engineer is Sergio Enriquez. Tides of History is produced by Morgan Jaffe. From Wondery, the executive producers are Leah Sutherland and Hernan Lopez. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, from Wondery, this has been Tides of History.
Let's jump into Peppa's world of play. Look for spring flowers, hunt for muddy puddles, and bravely explore exciting places with Peppa play sets. Peppa Pig, inspiring kid confidence.